I enjoyed all of that, and I was curious through your speech as to whether you can think back to your times in the cabinet or more broadly in other leadership positions. When you're debating policy or arguing for new direction or formulating, you know, facing challenges, did you have the opportunity to debate and argue from a Christian viewpoint? And did that come up, or are you just articulating your views as they are? Was there an opportunity for that kind of conversation about why we're here and what service means from a Christian viewpoint?
All of the above. There were times when it didn't. 90% of what goes through our parliaments, you wouldn't know this because all you see is a controversy, is agreed, is good sound policy, and it's straightforward, and there are things that you obviously ought to do. And that ranges right through to the unbelievably controversial, and the times when morally it's a minefield, you know, and I went through quite a few of those, and I still couldn't tell you today. I won't know until the other side of the grave whether the government called it right and whether I called it right, both on some of the times when the government got it plainly wrong and plainly right. It's, you know, it's a very, very complicated world we live in. But I can think of quite a few occasions when the government that I was part of said, yes, from the point of view of upholding the values and the beliefs that drove the values that the society that we live in, we care about, it came up quite a few times in education. Choice for parents. Let the parents choose, if they don't want a secular education, for example. We want to make it easier for them to choose otherwise. And even one of the people around the cabinet room said, yes, that will be good for Christianity, though I'm not a Christian. It happened. I remember it. I don't know whether it'll be in the cabinet papers when they're released many years down the road. There were other times, I mentioned one of them, the comment about intergenerational theft was profoundly rooted in the idea of loving your neighbour. You get what I mean by that, don't you? It's looking after our children. They're probably the neighbours for whom we have the most responsibility. But have you noticed something about children today, the kids that are voiceless? Whether or not their point of view is taken into account depends on not the intrinsic value of every life anymore, but whether we want that child or not. And C.S. Lewis said, a society that takes control over future generations is a society that needs to be very careful indeed. And I would argue that we have failed his test. So the answer is that quite often, yes. And there were many times, of course, when I wasn't entirely comfortable with where we went. No, there weren't many, but there were times. Did I ever feel? And remember, God is often disappointed with the choices we make, but he doesn't walk away from us. Sometimes people, and this happened to me, people would say, I'm a Christian, I disagree with what you did or what the government did. And regardless of whether I did or not, you know, my response was to sort of say, now, you know, you've done things too that God doesn't grieve God, but he hasn't given up on you. And, you know, God does give us the right to determination, you know, over our own affairs. We'll be called to account for it, but he is amazingly forgiving.
Thanks for that question, and thank you for keeping to a question as well. I will just invite that if people would like to make a statement, then perhaps afterwards would be a good time. For now, if you can keep to questions, that would be fantastic. And pop up your hand if there is another question. Lainey will bring the microphone down your way. I believe there's a question up the back.
Hi, John. What do you think about the leadership from the West in response to Russia at the moment?
You'll see I'm trying to choose my words carefully. I think the problem for the West is, it's part and parcel of what I was referring to today. We've weakened ourselves in every possible way, including in terms of our own moral authority. And I think that we will do almost anything now to avoid pain. I'm a father, so I don't want to see children put at risk, my children put at risk. I understand that sentiment well. But, you know, Charles Colson once commented, if there's nothing worth dying for, then there's nothing worth living for either. So I think the West is in very great danger of losing its moral authority. And we need to wake up to ourselves very, very quickly. Stop assuming that the world is a nice place, because it often isn't. And sometimes someone has to take a tough stand. Now, as you know, the West and the UN are in great ferment at the moment. I haven't heard tonight's news over exactly how to respond, and that's a very, very tough thing. I hope we see some flutterings of moral authority again. But I'm not sure that we should be sanguine about that.
There's a question over here in this aisle. If you have a question, please feel free to pop your hand up ahead of time as well and be able to identify you. Great, thank you.
John, you mentioned the talks about the issue of pride to begin with, but how do you see humility fall into its place? Because pride is something that's talked about quite a lot as being a barrier to leadership, but conversely, talking about humility taking its place is something that's not necessarily have the same amount of focus. So how do you see humility being put in its place to actually have effective leadership?
Well, the first comment I'd make is I think it's very hard in an age when we interpret or understand others through the media or public figures through the media. It's very hard sometimes to understand them. But I do think the Australian people are quite discerning, and one thing I've noticed is that they pick up on authenticity. They crave it, and when they see it, they do recognise it. I think it's one of the endearing things about Australians. And, you know, authentic people are usually people who are realistic, so they've limited their pride. There is a measure of humility there. I think there's a desperate shortage of those people. They're out there. We desperately need more of them. And can I say this? I think one of the problems is that there are many, many decent Australians in this day and age who would very much like to make a contribution in the public space, but because they're not so puffed up with pride, they perhaps lack the confidence. Don't fall into that trap. You know, form sober opinions of yourself and of those around you. If you've got young people that you think can make a great public contribution, I say this with some feeling because I would never have thought I could have. Others, two older men that I respected, you know, said to me, John, we think you can make a contribution. If you will run, we will get back behind you for reasons X, Y, and Z. And I think that's important as well. But you know, from a Christian perspective, I bring nothing to God. But the great thing is I matter to him. I have dignity before him. He's paid an extraordinary price for me because he loves me. But the more I know of myself, the more amazed I am that he did so, because I'm not worthy of it. And, you know, I think people recognize humility and they embrace it when they see it. But real humility, too, will be wise. And it will be sober in its judgment. And sometimes, as Churchill put it, you do meet people who are very modest, but they have a great deal to be modest about. And it probably would be better if they didn't try and get out there in the front line. Think these things through carefully and work with those around with you. You know, I love this country. I'm sure you all do too. We want to see good people in public life. And we have them. We just need more of them. And we need them to be better recognised. We need to be more discerning. But the key point I want to say to you tonight is it does come back to each one of us. We need to be accountable to the God who loves us, but who will call us to account one day.
Okay, another question from this side.
John, I just wondered if you could comment on the difficulty of running as a leader against a media circus that we witness on a daily basis. I find it incredibly frustrating to try and to discern the truth from what I hear and read. As Mark Twain once said, if you don't read a newspaper, you're uninformed, and if you read a newspaper, you're misinformed.
Yeah.
And I think that's compounded many times since he said that. And the modern media circus that we see today really is incredibly frustrating.
I'll give you an interesting illustration of that. I was talking about it with Stuart Brooking. I'm over here with Overseas Council Australia, by the way, and I know some of you will be coming to our functions. Overseas Council Australia is a mission organisation, and we support colleges in the developing world so they can train their pastors and leaders for tomorrow in a culturally relevant way. So there you go. There's the promo. Entirely sympathetic, to what you're trying to do, Paul, and they work together. But I'm very passionate about that ministry because, you know, I am so conscious that every individual matters so much. And if we can find effective ways to work with people in their own culture, I'm all for it. And that's what this does, because our culture is losing it. And to come to your question, an interesting illustration, I was talking with Stuart Brooking about this afternoon, was a thing in Sydney called Connect09, where the Diocese of Sydney got together, I think it was meant to be 39 prominent Australians, you know, 39 articles for those of you who are Anglicans. And anyway, there were 38 plus me. Okay? And we were asked over 2 or 3 weeks in Sydney to participate in small forums in pubs and clubs and breakfast bars and universities and all sorts of things to talk about our faith. So there you had, you know, 36 Australians, from treasurers to former deputy prime ministers to generals to admirals to sportsmen and women and scientists. A very interesting group of people. While Christopher Hitchens was down at the Opera House. Now, you know Christopher Hitchens? He's now dead, but he was one of the leading new atheists. And while he was down there at the ABC-sponsored Dangerous Ideas Conference, your ABC, working for you, he made a pronouncement one... Is the ABC here? No. A bit like what I'm about to say about them. They, you know, he made the pronouncement. Christopher Hitchens said, "Only an infantile mind today believes in the resurrected Christ." That's what he said. Pretty insulting to his brother, Peter Hitchens, who's written a book, How Atheism Converted Me to Christianity, The Rage Against God, and he's every bit as bright as Peter. Now, that doesn't suit the narrative of the media. That was picked up and run everywhere in the media. But at the same time in that city, Sydney, you know, the second best city in Australia, I don't say that when I'm over there, but the same time, you've got 36 Australians saying they do believe in the resurrected Christ. Where was the media? Well, they were all down there with Christopher Hitchens. I would have thought they could have had some real sport. If they were professional, they would have recognised, here is a really good story. You put the microphone under the treasurer of Australia's nose and say, you're an imbecile. Christopher Hitchens told me that you're an imbecile. What do you say to that? Wouldn't that have been a good story? I actually think it's an important story. You know, I welcome the new atheists. I think it's terrific that they're out there challenging us. The problem is that you don't hear the other side by the people who lubricate the public debate, the media. And they'll say, oh, no, we do it on Q&A. Yeah, well, those stacked audiences? They're not real Australian audiences. I'm not saying the people in them aren't real Australians, but I am saying they're not a cross-section of real Australians or of genuine cross. You know what I mean by that? But let me just say this, God will not be mocked. Here is the great problem for the new atheists. In the end, this is a little Western indulgence. You know that? You stop and think about it. The new atheists got busy after September the 11th, 2001, the Twin Towers. Religion is the cause of the problem. It very rapidly morphed into Christianity as the problem because it's the only one that's safe to attack, isn't it? Because Christians turn the other cheek. You know, you don't go to Saudi Arabia and say that Islamic belief is the problem. You know, have you seen Dawkins go to Saudi Arabia and say that? But here's their problem. It is a Western indulgence. We are a culture in decline that's deserted our belief systems and thinks that this will be an age of secularism. We won't even be influencing it if we keep making ourselves as irrelevant as we are now. The coming century, ladies and gentlemen, will not be an age of atheism and of secularism the way the Peter Hitchenses and the Dawkinses and so much of today's intelligentsia and our teachers, or the people at least who control the curriculum, would like it to be. It will not be. It will be an age of immense ferment and debate over beliefs and creeds. And my plea, my before God, is that he will make it respectful and lead people to him and to peace, that it won't result in some of the horrors that these debates can sometimes. So there you have it. Don't think that those people who control the debate in this country are going to influence global outcomes. They're more likely to simply make us irrelevant, in my view, because the rest of the world... Go and talk to leading Asian thinkers. The question for them is not, is there a God? It's, who is he and how do we relate to him? I don't know. A senior American academic I was talking to not very long ago has been working in Asia. He said, it's easier now for me to be a Christian academic in Asia where I can have debates about God because the starting point is not, is he there? It's not one of mockery because I believe in him. It's, let's have an informed and intelligent debate about what we believe. I go home and your starting point is that you've got to justify a belief in God. We are the ones who are out of touch. Can I say that? And in so-called multicultural Australia, and I say that slightly sarcastically only because so many of the people who say that's a wonderful thing, we ought to respect all the other cultures, what they're busily really doing, of course, is not respecting the other cultures because the other cultures still say, take the big questions. Here's this logo here today asking the big questions. They still regard those as important at the same time as we say that they're not.
There's another question up towards the back there on the side. Thanks.
Do you think it would be a lot harder for you to be the Christian politician that you were in today's government within the cabinet, all those kinds of things, and answering policy questions from that perspective?
The short answer is, in general, in any country in the West, yes, because I think the debate has got coarser, tougher, more personalised, and more morally relativistic all the time. You know, we are now paying a huge price for the abandonment of reason. You know, the atheists, I'm looking for some. There must be some here. You know, they constantly say Christians are irrational. And I was fascinated. I wish I could get it. But somebody, some atheist group, must have been a very honest group in America, set out to establish that people who went to church were less rational than people who didn't go to church and found precisely the opposite. Christians who really understand Christ are people committed to reason and bringing intelligent thought to everything from science to democracy to philosophy to art to whatever. That's the history of the West. But we're abandoning that. And so now we've abandoned even what Voltaire's biographer said Voltaire would have us do. I choose those words carefully for the philosophers amongst you. Voltaire was hardly a friend of Christianity. But he said, that famous quote, his biographer was summarising his views, I may disagree with you, but I defend to the death your right to say it. That is not the debating world we now live in. You see, if your views disagree with today's intelligentsia, the commentariat, the thought police, you will be mocked. That is very, very dangerous. You do not, can I say this as a former legislator, get good public policy, any policy, out of a bad debate. And you will not get a good debate if you intimidate people. Voltaire was saying that we must never personalise debates. We must respect the promoter of an idea enough to allow that person to put their idea on the table and then debate the idea. And that way we will get to the best outcome in terms of who wins the debate and where the policy goes. We are losing that so fast that I can only tell you thank you for the question, and I am terrified by my response, which is to say to you that it is deteriorating rapidly. It's going to make it harder and harder and harder of people of decency, committed to good public policy, to participate in it. And I mean no disrespect to any serving politicians at the moment. I actually think we've created the mess. By we, I mean, I'll say this. I think actually one of the great problems in the West is that the church has given way, not all of it, but far too much of it, to sloppy, irrational thinking, which has allowed too many others increasingly to get away with it, and now it's become a rampaging bushfire.
Another question from that side, up the back.
Thank you, John, for sharing with us today about your thoughts on leadership. One thing that I've noticed leaders struggle with is dealing with failure. In your time in the office and personally, as a leader who's Christian, how did you deal with failure?
Very badly, very badly. I'll say something very immodest. I was a politician who was able, with some effort and with plenty of help from my friends, to contain my pride when I had a win. But where my pride came out was when I was under attack or when I'd failed and I wanted to say I haven't failed and I haven't done the wrong thing. So it's the other side of the coin. Often our pride's the biggest problem when actually we need to be truly humbled and say, I got it wrong and I need to face up to that and I need to repent. But you see, we live in an age where the intelligentsia have told us, never explain, never apologise. You can't be wrong. There's no such thing as guilt because we've tried to do away with the whole idea of sin. Can I tell you, freedom for me is knowing that I'm a deeply flawed and failed human being, but I still matter. Not by my own merit, but because the creator of the universe, I deeply and profoundly believe this. I believe it more as every day goes by, as I get older, says that I matter. He was prepared to pay an extraordinary price to have me back in his tent as part of his family.
Question down the front here.
Sorry, my English is not good. Number one, I have three items. Number one, I'm Muslim. Number one is just information that we believe Jesus will come again here to the earth. This is our belief. Number two, why Australia to get visa to visit Australia very difficult, while to go to US or to Europe more easy than to Australia. While tourist is good for money. That's number two. Number three, this is my I might be wrong. My understanding that here in Christianity, turning to atheist more than in Indonesia, from Islam to atheist. I don't know if that's correct or not, but that's my. Okay, thank you.
Can I take the and just repeat it to make sure I've got it right? Can I take the second comment as a question? John, you might have caught it, but the second part, the first part was that you're a Muslim. Sorry, say again.
Number one is only information that we believe.
Yeah, part two.
We don't know. That's number one, information. Number two, about visa, tourist.
Yes, sorry, your second was a question. John, would you like to comment on whether you agree that it's easier to come to Australia as a tourist than as a citizen or a resident?
No, to a tourist.
Oh, okay, so your question was, why is it easier for tourists to come to Australia than to America?
Europe.
To Europe.
Why difficult to get visa to Australia than to Europe or
America? Okay, yes. So your observation is that you have observed that it's easier to get a visa to Europe or to America than to Australia. And the question would be, why do you believe that to be the case?
You're from Indonesia?
Yeah.
Well, it's lovely to have you here. I love your country. I go there often. And I think one of the great things we can agree on is that we debate with courtesy, and I respect so many of your people for their willingness to debate and their desire for wisdom. And I see you have a heart for wisdom. So thank you for coming tonight, and thank you for being so open. And I would love to encourage you to think more and engage more about the great issues that we're talking about tonight. On the second issue of whether it's harder to get a visa now into Europe than Australia or America, I would have to plead some ignorance. I honestly can't answer that. All I can tell you is that we do have the highest immigration rates of any country in the OECD, and our population is growing faster than any other country in the OECD. I don't know the detail. I can try and find out for you, but I can't give you a detailed answer. It's lovely to have you here. And I am one who, in my own very humble way, does everything I can to build a better relationship between your country and its people and ours. And one of the great moments in my life was, had a terrible time for your country, was to be acting Prime Minister and to be able to make the decision with John Howard, who was on holidays at the time, that after the tsunami we should do something really momentous. And as you know, we put in $1 billion. And that was meant to be a very clear signal of solidarity with your people. And I know that it is. One of the lovely things about Indonesians is that they remember kindnesses and acts of generosity.
Okay, another question. Oh, well, I might take the liberty of asking a quick question that was discussed before. You've touched on the question of Christians relating to the state, and church and state is a hot topic, and you made a comment about the church and its possible failure in being a voice for reason and its opinions. Do you have any comments on how you have approached the issue of church and state, particularly in political leadership?
I'm an absolute believer in the separation of church and state. Jesus made it very plain. The realms are separate. You know, with the famous trap question, you know, is it legal to pay taxes to Caesar? Show me a coin. Whose image is this? Caesar's. Then render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. Have you ever stopped to think there's a mystery in that? Why didn't Jesus ask the next obvious question of the person who'd handed him the coin and those standing around? You know what the next obvious question was? Whose image do you bear? And therefore, to whom do you belong? That was the logical next question that's left hanging. I believe in the separation of church and state. I most certainly do not believe that people of Christian belief and conscience should be excluded from the public arena. Just the opposite. I think they have a huge amount to contribute and they should be active in it. And I think, with modesty, it is right for us to remind people that it was the worldview that we still represent that's so forgotten today that our society was built on, and we would do well. That's why I've done it tonight, to the best of my ability, to say, stop. You're not exactly building the best of all worlds here. You better rethink a little bit. I'm sure that Jesus' main reason for separating the two was in the interests of his bride, the church. Whenever you've given the church temporal power, it's wanted to dictate to people how they should live rather than do the hard work, which is, of course, Christ's real work of winning people's hearts, much harder. So much better for the church not to have temporal power. My comment about it failing in the public square, though, was that having been set free, I use that word advisedly, set free of temporal power, it then had, and for many years, for many decades, centuries even, usually on balance, used its public voice for good, but then it wilted. I'm of Presbyterian background. Am I allowed to admit that here? You know, I'm ashamed to say that in many ways, at a very low ebb, the Presbyterian Church in Scotland helped lead Europe into the so-called Enlightenment, when the Age of Reason was slowly whittled away. That's what really happened in the Enlightenment. You know, they repented, or large slabs of the church did, and turned back, but a lot of damage had already been done.
Okay, another question from over here.
Yeah, John, just wondering, how optimistic are you about Australia having moral authority? I listened to some speakers last year at the World Congress of Families, and we had African and Russian speakers saying, well, thank you for your Christian witness over the last century. Now it's our time to take the lead, because you seem to be failing in terms of family and pushes for sexual diversity and whatnot. With the rise of Christianity in China, do we really see Russia and China and India having more moral authority than Australia?
That was a great conference. There's only 600 people at it, and it was organised by the Catholic Church. They put one on internationally every year. A very eclectic mixture of academics from just about every belief in the broadly Christian fold, and there were some brilliant contributions. What a great shame. The only media coverage it got was from a speaker who'd once talked about homosexuals reversing their homosexuality. That was the only time the media came, and yet they were talking about things that are of critical importance to the children and therefore the societies of tomorrow. It was tragic. But the choice is ours in this country. You know, Australia, almost alone amongst Western countries, still might have its best days in front of it. I don't believe that's true of very many Western countries. It may be of this one. I suspect whether or not that happens depends very largely on people like us. If we'll be a people who will humble ourselves and get on our knees and really plead for God to intervene with our neighbours and to rebuild a heart in this country, who knows what might happen. But some of the exterior evidence isn't too good. I mean, we go on celebrating the diversity of families while the atheist regime in China asks Alpha to instructs Alpha to make its marriage guidance books available in every single bookshop in China because they're worried about the divorce rate in China. They think it's a problem. 5,000 applications a day amongst the 1.2 billion people. It's probably well below the rate in many Western societies, but the Chinese recognise it's a social and economic problem of massive proportions. So what do? They invite the Anglican Church in London in the form of, in its guise as Alpha, they give its marriage course book an ISBN number and instruct them to place it in every single bookshop in China. Tells you something, doesn't it?
Question over here on this slide.
Thank you, John. Just a question. As a Christian member of Parliament, I find that in many ways much of the church has abandoned the public square and retreated behind the walls of the church, and we can sing our songs and preach the gospel and have a great merry time, but Christians largely have abandoned the public square. And just wondering whether you've got any ideas on how to re-engage the Christian community, and yeah, do you see a changing trend? I see bits of some parts of the church really getting on side and getting involved in the public square, but to considering the size of the Christian church-going community, we have minuscule influence. I often say to people, 2% of the population describes itself as same-sex, homosexual, lesbian, yet what influence have they had? Roughly 10% of the population is church-going. If we got organised, we could actually really bring some change. You got any comment on that?
Well, lovely to see you, and thank you for what you do in the public square, and your brothers in their different ways. The question vexes me. I understand why. It's very, very easy to feel intimidated, and we don't like being painted as nasty people. And our opponents are incredibly good at it. And sometimes some of our friends make the mistake of returning fire in similar language as well, which makes us cringe even more. But my plea would be, I think, look, heed the challenge in Mr. Abetz's words. We do need to be active in the public square. There are ways to be active in the public square. You know, there really are. You join a political party, write letters, participate in the debates in the pubs, join ACL or a lobby group. But I just wonder, really, it's not as if Christians have ever been a majority in any society. I mean, I've said many times tonight that the Christian worldview was the one that shaped our society. It came together with enough people of enough faith before God, determination, articulation, to be able to persuade enough others who could see what a mess things were in to change the direction of their societies. This is a time like that. The challenge is, will there be enough who will stand up? So your challenge is a good one. We need to do it thoughtfully and prayerfully. And, I referred to the first commandment. We leave the word out with all your mind. We're not dumb. We're painted as dumb because that suits the opponents who want us right where they've got us, by the way, marginalised. But we are actually the people. I've tried to tease out some of the issues tonight from a Christian perspective. Can I say you? Don't be proud or smug about this, but we are the people who have the keys to understanding the mess that we're in and the way back. The world doesn't. Sorry, but it doesn't. If it did, I pose a very simple question. Where are all the talking heads on our television sets in 2006-07 warning of the economic chaos that was about to descend on the world? They're not as clever as they think they are. It's just that their arrogance lets them sound so clever, and their nastiness enables them to be so capable of putting down. That sort of stuff can be fought back against, and I'd encourage you to do so.
Perhaps time for two more questions. So there's a question here on the aisle on this side in about the middle, which we might make our second last question for the night.
John, to have a leader, you've got to have people who you're leading. Okay. So you described today the quality of a good leader, but also you've got to have the people who you are leading. How do you find Australian people in general? How hard are they to lead compared to people of other countries? Say, for example, the horn in a car is used in other countries to communicate, but here it replaces the middle finger.
Car horn.
Yeah. Right. Well, some of you will have heard Peter Pollack here, the South African. He made a comment to me. He said Australians, in his view, are still open to sound reason. He said he believes that some other Western countries now, they've just shut down, won't listen at all. I think Australians do still respond to authenticity and sincerity. I believe they do. I'd like to believe that. We're seen as one of the most irreligious countries on earth, but I'm not sure that that is right. I do think we have a huge responsibility, though, as I say, to use our minds, to use all the talents that God has given us. They're not ours, they come from Him, so we need to use them in His service, to engage in these debates again and to demonstrate, to live out a better way. I think people are looking for a better way. Now, it's hard because of the sarcasm that is heaped upon those who embrace Christianity by those who think they have a better way. But look at the society they're giving us, and their answer is more of the same, the smugness that won't allow them to join up the dots, and it leads them to try and stop you and me from joining up the dots and our children from joining up the dots. Maybe I'll give Churchill the last word on this. He said, any society that wants to hand on to its children the best of its inheritance will make certain that they understand what that inheritance is. And history is now so badly taught and is so deeply silent on the great ideas that formed our society that our children don't have a chance. It's not going to be their fault. It's going to be those of us who allowed the wrong people to determine what they were taught.
Okay, perhaps if we have one final question. Yes, question down the front, please.
I'm not trying to be controversial, so deflect the question if you want to. But what's occurred to me is your perspective as a former legislator as well as a Christian, who owns or who has the right to the definition of marriage?
Well, I think it's a very, very good question. I think I would say that in my case, the church or the state, and I think I'd have to split that. I'm not trying to deflect it. Because I've had to think this through myself. So as a legislator, I have to say to people, I think, here are the public policy reasons why I think family matters and why I think same-sex marriage poses great problems. There are two essential problems. One is it will result in a curtailment of the most basic rights of all, which are freedom of thought and expression. It will. It will. You're already seeing that in states where people can't pass on to their children their own views on the right way for them to maintain their sexuality for fear of offending other kids in the classroom. Then the school gets involved, then the government and the authorities get involved, and they have to stand by saying, you cannot tell your children that one form of sexual expression is more appropriate than others. So it will result in that, and that's a serious issue. Now, society doesn't seem to understand how important freedom of belief and expression actually is. And the second thing is that for the first time, when you go down this road, the state gets into the business of saying that a piece of paper bears greater authority than biological reality, and some children can be denied normal access to one of their biological parents. That's a whole new class of people, and I think that's really troublesome. So those are the legislator's reasons. And the state does have an interest, by the way, in family. It has a legitimate interest in family. This trite nonsense that's trotted out sometimes that the state should keep out of, it's usually said keep out of the bedroom or whatever, but it means keep out of our personal affairs. The state does have an interest. The economic and social and strategic ramifications of a society where you have huge problems with dislocation of children and what have you, we've seen that time and time again with some of the debates we've had in the parliament. They're really serious issues. And the cost of family breakup in economic terms is really serious. That's why the Chinese are trying to stop it. You don't hear it debated here. Here's another irony. Global warming, you know, was the great moral challenge of the age. You know, one of the things that was seeing the West, one of the West's greatest contributions to global warming was family breakup. Smaller households. So instead of having one fridge, one hot water system and maybe two cars, you have two of everything. See the problem? Bigger houses with fewer people living in them all the time. Fragmentation. Extraordinary. But, you know, you won't see that in the media either. Doesn't suit the narrative of the day. But in the end, who does marriage belong to? You know my perspective, I have absolutely no doubt about which kingdom will remain forever and which master will have the final say. And so in the end, as a believer, I think it's his standards. Now, I can't impose those on other people because he doesn't. He'll call them account for not respecting them one day. So it's a bundle of very tricky issues. But it's a good question, and thank you for it. Thank you very much for having me with you. If I have caused you any offence or misled you in any way or said something that is not true, I profoundly apologise. But my objective has been to encourage you to really engage your minds in, as the slogan here has it, ask the bigger questions. Why ask the bigger questions? Because each and every one of you matters extraordinarily, and that is the most fantastic news. But it's also dangerous news if you don't stop and engage and come to a conclusion about it. It's dangerous in this life, and I would argue even more dangerous in the next. So thank you for having me with you. Always fun to be over here on an aeroplane again. I used to live my life on aeroplanes. This one got us here in good time today. That's always a relief, and all of our baggage was there. Good airline. I'll tell you a little story just so you know who has the real power when you're traveling, okay? A friend of mine was lined up, it's a true story I might add, to check in his baggage and to fly to the west coast of America. The bloke in front of him was very rude to the girl behind the counter and personally abusive at that. So when my friend, eventually she managed to calm him down, get his baggage, send him shuffling off with his tickets, boarding pass. My friend got there and said, you were very patient with that man, I'm very impressed. And she exclaimed, well, she said, it was frustrating, but we're taught well here never to take it personally. The trick is never to take it personally, and then you don't get angry and you don't want to take it out on their hides. And so, you know, he's had the taxi was late this morning, or he's had a row with his wife. It's not my fault. It's not the airline's fault. My friend said, well, you know, you must still want to take it out. No, she said, no. I'm able to put it behind me. And he said, you're smiling. You're trying to hide it. But there's more to it, isn't there? No. He said, no, I'm a psychologist. You're hiding something. Tell me the truth. Well, she said, don't tell anyone, but if you must know, you're both booked to LA, and you'll stagger off the plane with jet lag and fatigue at 6 o'clock in the morning, and down to find your luggage, and both of you will find your luggage on carousel 2, yours in LA and his in Amsterdam.